From Michigan Radio, I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a special edition of Stateside, Flint, 5 years after the water switch that triggered the water crisis. We'll hear from the people of Flint.
Sitting in the lines and getting the water and bringing it home and trying to cook with it and still fussing and cussing all at the same time.
In the evening when I get off work, I've got to think, like, do I have water at home? 6 years ago, that wasn't a thought.
We'll talk with Flint's mayor.
Until we get all of the pipes replaced, we're going to err on the side of putting health and well-being above everything.
And talk with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha.
My interests are making sure that the children of Flint will not only recover but thrive, and that's how I spend my day.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. April 25th, 2014. Smiling Flint officials raise their glasses of water in a toast.
Here's to Flint.
Here's to Flint.
Here.
The city's drinking water source had just been switched from Detroit's system to the local Flint River to save money. Soon people were turning up at Flint City meetings, bearing bottles and jugs of discolored, smelly water. Even as complaints poured in, then State DEQ spokesman Brad Werfel had this to say in the summer of 2015.
Anyone who is concerned about lead in the drinking water in Flint can relax.
But as the world knows, that was not true. Today, the Flint water crisis is seen as one of the worst public health crises in history, and life will never be the same for the 100,000 people who trusted their state and city to provide clean, safe drinking water. Today, a special edition of Stateside, Flint, 5 years later, and we begin with the people. Amber Hassan is the mother of six children aged 4 to 18. Her youngest was a baby during the height of the water crisis. Amber, here we are, 5 years later. How are you and your kids doing now?
We're all doing well. You know, we still deal with the same issues pretty much that we dealt with 5 years ago with the water crisis, but we have adjusted, and things that used to seem like a real hardship have just become part of our everyday routine.
What kinds of things?
Like in the evening when I get off work, I've got to think, like, do I have water at home? 6 years ago, that wasn't a thought. Do I have water at home? It was like, I have water hooked up to my house. So yes, I have water at home. Now, even with water coming to my faucet, I have to think, do I have water that I can drink at home? And so if I don't, I have to make an extra stop at the store. And then sometimes we'll go to the store and they'll be sold out of waters. So it's just some things that we had to do to adjust how we live our lives.
Do I understand from what you're saying, you are still just using bottled water? Do you trust what's coming out of your tap?
I do not. I do not drink any water out of the tap. My children don't drink any water out of the tap. We only consume bottled water.
Now, has your lead service line been replaced where you live, Amber?
Yes, where I live currently it has.
But, and even though you've got officials saying, well, you know, it looks like the water is within safe levels, what would it take to get that trust back?
There is probably nothing that they can do to get that trust back, because there was a point where they were saying, no, it's fine, drink the water. They even had politicians and the like publicly, quote unquote, drinking the water. And it just, at this point, I feel like they will say anything. And so I don't trust it at all.
What about political leaders or community leaders? Are there any that you trust now?
I trust them as much as they're educated. And many times, people just aren't educated on all the issues. So at this point, I just really, I try to be supportive, but I keep a healthy amount of skepticism when dealing with politicians.
Do you know, Amber, if your health or the health of your children was at all affected by that water?
I'm not sure. I have lupus, and so at the time, I had a lot of flare-ups, but I don't know if it was because of the water. I know that, you know, with lead, if it's in your system, and you don't find out within, I think it's the first 30 days, you can never really find out. At that point, it's in the blood, and, you know, the way to find out is already that window has passed. So I don't know, because we didn't know right away. So my children could have very well been affected.
And how is your water bill?
Currently, because I don't use the water for anything but to bathe in, we try not to even wash our hair in the water. My water bill is about $20 per month, but that's just for water. For the service fees, that's an extra $60. So my $20 water bill is an $80 water bill because of service fees for water that I don't believe I can use.
Amber, the criminal charges against state and local officials have not yet led to a single trial. How important is it to you to see somebody held accountable for all that's happened to Flint?
I think that's at the top of the list, with the top of the list being that people are kept healthy and that people are kept informed and that these man-made environmental issues aren't used to oppress people. But after that, I think holding the people accountable who allowed this to happen, because it wasn't as if the memos didn't come across, you know, people's desk and the emails weren't sent. These things were put out there and they got overlooked, and people's lives were at stake and people died and people were sick and kids were affected and old people were affected, and, you know, everybody was affected in this city. And I don't think anybody who had to maneuver through the water crisis trust the water from any municipality anymore, not just Flint.
Amber Hassan, we want to thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
We turn now to another Flint resident. Doris Allen is here with us. Doris, how long have you lived in Flint and in this home?
In my home, I've been in here since June of 92.
And how long have you been a Flint resident?
I've been a Flint resident since 1974.
All right. Lots of years in Flint. When did you first know that there was something wrong with your water?
Well, I noticed it when my water was starting to turn really yellow. And once they said that and I started sending in the readings and things from my water, my first reading I got back, Cindy, was like a 2400. So I've been going to all of the meetings about the lead for the testings and things of that nature, you know.
How did it feel when you got that test result, that incredibly high amount of lead? What did you feel at that moment?
You know, once they announced that they were switching over to the Flint water, and just looking from the TV and seeing that, and then knowing that I've got this reading, how in the world can you do that to people? So when I got that first reading, I didn't want to believe it. I'm sitting here now looking at my papers that I have here from all of my tests that I've done over the years. And just to know that I have over 300 pounds per billion in lead in my water, 300. And it just, you know, all these years, how can Snyder or any other public figure do that to human beings? So I'm in outrage over it.
Did this affect your health? How is your health now?
Well, during this time, my immune system, I did go seek doctors from skin doctors, dermatologists, yes. And I have here with pictures in front of me from my legs and things that I broke out really bad with. Now, rashes and medications that I had to get. Because being a cancer survivor, my immune system had already been compromised. So now with this water issue, that just made me more vulnerable to the water.
Now, has your lead service line been replaced, Doris?
It has been. They replaced it in June of 2017, yes.
So your lead service line has been replaced. Do you trust the water that comes out of your tap?
No, I don't. I have filters on it right now to this day that I have to take off, and I can see little particles still on that filter that I have to rinse off and stuff. So I still, however, have a filter on my shower that I shower with. But to trust it, to drink it, or to cook with, no, I don't.
A number of state and local officials have been criminally charged, but nobody's gone to trial at this point. I'm wondering, Doris, how important is it to you to see someone held accountable for everything that's happened in Flint?
Well, I would love to see that. That would be great, and particularly starting at the top from Snyder on down. But these are politicians and people in office that seems to be able to pass the buck along to someone else and down to the peons, where nobody wants to take responsibility for the actions that they've caused to human lives. They just don't want to do it. Had it been of another nature, then they'd be ready to put anybody, you know, put people away. But now that this has subsided and all of this has taken place, to me, they're just passing the buck. They're just prolonging the situation. They're wasting taxpayers' money instead of going to the source of where it started from. And that's down over to the water department, from Walling to Snyder to Early to whoever else was involved in that. Whatever part they paid in that, they need to pay for that.
What would it take for you to trust an elected leader again?
Now, that's a hard question because I don't know. You know, I vote and I vote my mind and I try to vote right. But right isn't always the right way sometimes, because until they actually get in that office, you never know what that, you know, they'll tell you one thing, but once they get in, it's something else altogether different. So, you know, a lot of things you just have to put in God's hand and hope you did the right thing and go with the flow. Do the best you can.
What about for yourself? What did you do to kind of rally the strength you needed to kind of weather this uncertainty of the water coming out of the tap, getting these sky-high lead reports, wondering about your health? How did you get through that?
Well, I prayed a lot. And then some things you have to do on your own, like, you know, you can't drink the water. So going and sitting in the lines and going and getting the water and bringing it home, and then, you know, trying to cook with it and still fussing and cussing all at the same time in the process, you know, in your home and not really understanding how in the world did this even happen. But so with me, I tried to make sure that my immune system itself was up to par. I still have to go to my doctors, my oncologist, my dermatologist, and then the side effects later on, even though doctors won't say that it's because of the lead, because they can't pinpoint it, I still feel that myself, that some of my issues and health issues that I have is from the water, because you've drank it all these years and for so long.
You've lived in the city of Flint since the early 1970s. Is this something you would have ever imagined would have happened to your city?
No, I wouldn't have never imagined it happening to anyone. Water is supposed to be a free thing, a healthy thing. Water is supposed to be healthy, and it's one thing that we need to survive on, you know, even in living down south where we had to pump our own water. We never had encountered anything of this nature, you know, never encountered anything like this. I wouldn't have thought that this would happen. I wouldn't have thought that even politicians or anything of that nature would even let it get this far.
Doris Allen, we want to thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. Welcome back to a special edition of Stateside, Flint, 5 years later. Karen Weaver is a clinical psychologist who was elected mayor of Flint in November 2015. Her task? Overseeing her city's recovery from the water crisis. Mayor Karen Weaver, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be back talking with you.
Mayor, I think quite a few people, not only here in Michigan, but across the country, think the water in Flint is still unsafe to drink. Is that accurate? Do people in Flint have clean drinking water?
Well, you know what? I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think there's some confusion about the state of our drinking water in Flint. Because one thing people have heard is, and I have continued to say to our community, is to continue with the bottled and filtered water. It does not mean that we have not made tremendous progress here in the city of Flint. We're almost finished with the pipe replacement. Our goal is to have that done by the end of the summer. When we test our water, we continue to get good results. However, and that's where the confusion comes in.
Sure.
Until we get all of the pipes replaced, we're going to err on the side of putting health and well-being above everything. And in our conversations with the EPA, one of the things they have stated is that until we get all of the pipes looked at and or replaced, we should continue to err on the side of public safety. And so we are telling people to continue with bottled and filtered water, because one of the things that has also been told to us is while we're still pulling out lead pipes or galvanized pipes, you have that potential for lead to leach into the system. And so we want all of the pipes looked at and changed before we give the all clear. But I do also want to add that even though our goal is to have that completed by the end of the summer, I then want our medical community to say, okay, we want to continue to see stable results for a certain period of time before they give the all clear. So I'm really taking my direction from the health community here in the city of Flint before we do that.
The ACLU of Michigan is saying there are about some 7,000 water service lines that need to be checked and possibly replaced by your city. Does that ring true to you? Is that accurate?
It's probably between 5 and 7, correct. And that's why we're saying that. While we're a year ahead of schedule as far as the lead service line replacement, but we want to look at everything, and that's what we're doing. And that's what I'm saying we should have completed by the end of the summer, is looked at those pipes and those that are lead and galvanized, have them changed.
The city's public works director cited the Flint Water Distribution Optimization Plan when he recently said that in addition to the money that Flint has already received, the city's going to need to make about an excess of $300 million in additional improvements to the water system over the next 20 years. We all know Flint's finances were problematic before the water crisis. So how do you see the city paying for these needed improvements?
Well, some of the improvements we have continued to get some funding for, and we're still looking for more of that. In fact, initially when we did our intended use plan, one of the things we talked about was upgrading the meters. You know, we needed new meters. And we were able to use some of the funding to take care of that because we knew we could not do that. And so those are the conversations we're continuing to have, not only at the state level, but at the federal level as well, that there are still things that need to be fixed and Flint still needs to be made whole. How can we do that? And what kind of funding and what kinds of help are you going to give us? So that's what we're doing.
Let's talk water rates, Mayor Weaver. A 2016 national study found on average Flint residents pay the highest water rates in the nation. Are water rates still too high?
Yes, they are. And you know, it's so funny because I'm glad you brought that up. So many people don't realize that was what we were fussing and fighting about originally before the switch was the rates that we were paying. While we did have an emergency manager in place, we know our rates were raised. And that was our water woe at that time. And we're still paying high rates. One of the things we've been told really by the state is that, and this was before the new administration, they were trying to get us to increase our water rates. And that was something that I said, I cannot do that. There is no way in the world when what we are going through, we are going to raise the rates of the people. But one of the things we also recognized is, you know, that's what happens when you have a dwindling population. And that's why economic development was so important to this community. That's why housing was so important to this community, because we have to, you know, keep residents and bring new residents and new businesses so we can have a tax base to help take care of some of these things. You know, when our infrastructure was built, Flint was booming and we had a population of, you know, 200,000 plus, and our infrastructure was built for about 250,000. And when your city is cut in half, you still have those same water rates and half the population to pay for that. And so one of the things we've been doing, and I know people are paying attention, at least I hope, because water rates is also a public health issue, because when people can't afford to keep their water on and water gets shut off, you have all kinds of health concerns and health issues and challenges. And so we've been treating water rates as a public health issue, and that's why we have not raised the rates. And so we've been working with some other partners to say, what can we do about these water rates? And looking at a tiered rate system, we're looking at different options to see how we can address this.
Mayor Weaver, you told NPR's Morning Edition that Flint should have gotten more. That was your phrasing.
Yes, from
the previous Snyder administration. All right, what have been the differences in working with the new Governor Whitmer administration?
Well, and let me say this before I get into some of that, mm-hmm. because one of the things, and I'm still asking for this, when I talked about Flint should have gotten more, you know, we talk about how quickly we're changing these lead and galvanized pipes. We've been talking about how our water is testing at much better levels. But one of the issues was the in-home plumbing that was damaged. So you may have a person whose water tests high because their in-home plumbing was damaged, their fixtures were damaged. And that's what I'm talking about when I say we should have gotten more. I think that's something that should have been taken care of by the state. And initially, we had gotten approximately 4,000 fixtures for homes. And we were told at first that we were going to get 4,000 a year over 3 years, which which would have been 12,000, but we only got the 4. And so that's been a problem. And that's where I'm saying we still need help. We still deserve more. People's appliances were damaged. That's an area where we're still having conversation with the state about that.
But then are there differences? Are you finding differences in working with the new Whitmer administration?
Well, I'm hoping so. I'm certainly hoping so. We had our first meeting to talk about, okay, here's an update on Flint. Here's where we are, and here's where some of our needs and challenges continue to be. So we've just gotten started, and I'm hoping for some positive results. I do have a concern when I sit around the table and I see some of the same people with MDEQ. That's troublesome for the people of the city of Flint because, you know, we have trust issues. So we're going to see how that part works. But we were able to sit down and say, here's what we've done. Here's what we still need to do. Here's the direction we're going. And we're going to see how it goes.
If you've just joined me, I'm speaking with Flint's Mayor Karen Weaver. We're marking the 5th anniversary of the city being switched to river water from the Flint River, which was the beginning of what the world now knows as the Flint water disaster. When you look at Lansing, Mayor Weaver, from lawmakers, state agencies, the MDEQ, Health and Human Services, the governor's office, do you get a sense that anything was learned from Flint's water crisis? Have you seen changes?
You know what? I hope something was learned from Flint's water crisis, and I hope that it was learned not just here, but all across the country. I hope people have, I told them, don't let us go through a crisis and not learn from us. So I hope people are looking at not taking water standards for granted. I hope people are learning about the importance of maintaining and investing in their infrastructure. Those are the lessons that we hope are learned as a result of this and the damaging impact that it can have and how difficult it is to rebuild trust when something like that happens. But one of the things we also learned is while there are trust issues, you know, people have said, well, why are we even having MDEQ doing the testing? Well, that's what they're supposed to do. You know, that's what they're supposed to do, and we're going to hold them to that. But because there is a lack of trust there for the people of the city of Flint, that was why we had the outside or the independent testers come in. And that was very, very important to us. And I do believe that they understand that. At least I hope so. I hope so.
I want to pivot over to the prosecutions of the city and the state officials.
Have there been any?
Well, they've been slow to a crawl. How important is it for people of Flint to see people held criminally accountable for their actions?
It's very important. And that's one of the things we've asked for from the very beginning, and we've still been waiting. And while charges have been made, no one has really been held accountable for what has happened in the city of Flint. You know, we've had not only kids that have been damaged by drinking lead poisoned water. We've had pregnant women that had miscarriages. We know we had a higher rate of miscarriages and stillbirths. We know we lost people to Legionnaires. People died as a result of that. And the list goes on. We know people with compromised immune systems have been severely impacted. And that's a problem. And for no one to be held accountable is very troublesome. Because if somebody came in, you know, we've had, what, I believe 13 people that died as a result of the Legionnaires. If someone came in and shot 13 people and had been caught, they'd be in prison. But no one has been held to that level of accountability for what has happened in the city of Flint. And I think that's a sad thing.
Can Flint move on?
We are moving on.
But can Flint heal and can trust be rebuilt without anyone being convicted?
You know, we're moving on because we have to. And I think that's a testament to our strength and our resiliency. We're not going to let this stop us because Flint is coming back strong. And if you come to Flint and you see what's going on, people are just so surprised about the progress that we've made and that we're continuing to make here in the city. I mean, we finally got named to a great list of the top 125 best places to live. We haven't had that kind of positive attention on us in a long, long time. So we're moving on because, you know, we keep telling people we're Flintstone strong. So we'll move on. Now, when you talk about trust, there are some people that said they won't trust water anywhere. They will always use bottled and filtered water, whether they stay in Flint or move someplace else. One of the things we are telling people still is
get your water tested, because those are the things that are going to reestablish trust. That's why it was important to train some of our own people to be able to do this testing, because we trust each other. It's important to be able to hire local people to be part of this healing process. And that's what we've been very intentional about, is making sure that we, the residents of the city of Flint and people from Genesee County, are involved in the rebuilding. And I don't want you to get me wrong. We appreciate help from everybody, and we take help from everybody, but we have to be part of this process for healing and to reestablish trust.
What else will it take to earn people's trust back?
I think it's going to take a number of years to earn people's trust back, because other things that happened in the city of Flint prior to the water crisis, and that just seemed to be the straw that broke the camel's back. It's easy to break trust in the blink of an eye, but it takes years to reestablish it sometimes. You know, we were told in the beginning that the pipes would recoat themselves, and let's just let that happen. I said, no, people aren't going to trust that. I don't trust that. We deserve to see new pipes going into the ground. That's how you're going to start reestablishing trust, making sure the people from Flint and Genesee County get some of these jobs that come along with the crisis. That's going to reestablish trust. Seeing companies come in like Lear, seeing new housing coming in, that we got that $30 million from HUD, and we're putting that across from Lear. Next year it will be across from Diplomat. Seeing new parks and playgrounds happen, seeing us be a healthy, thriving community again, are the things that are going to reestablish trust.
And when you think of the international attention that mm-hmm. has been put on Flint, along with things that you've just alluded to, tens of millions in funding from the state, from the federal government, not to mention private donations, with that kind of momentum going, are Flint residents better off because of the water crisis?
I don't know. Because if I was one of the people that lost my loved one to Legionnaires, am I better off? I don't know. If my child was damaged cognitively, or I see they need mental health services now, or they ended up in the juvenile justice system, am I better off? I don't know. What we decided to do was take this because we knew opportunity would come as a result. And so when you're dealt a bad hand, you better try to play it well. And I think that's what we've done. We said we're not going to have a crisis come in and not make opportunity happen for our people. So some things are happening that are great things. And it's just too bad that a crisis had to take place for these great things to happen, because they're things that should happen in communities anyway.
Mayor Karen Weaver, when we talk to you 5 years from now, the 10th anniversary of the switch to the Flint River, what do you hope you'll be able to tell us?
What I said, we played a bad hand well. We really, really did. And I think that if we can come through this crisis in the manner in which we're doing and making great things happen for our city, I think we give other people hope in their communities. That's part of what I enjoy hearing. People have told us that we're watching Flint and we're learning from Flint. We have made this country have a conversation that was long overdue about water quality standards and about infrastructure. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Karen Weaver, Mayor of the City of Flint, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Now for a brief update on the criminal prosecutions of state and local officials. You just heard Mayor Weaver sarcastically asked, have there been any? Referring to the plodding pace of many of the court proceedings. Michigan Radio's Flint reporter Steve Carmody is here with us. Steve, overall, there were 15 state and local officials hit with a range of criminal charges over their actions either before, during, or after the switch to the Flint River. So how many have already pleaded guilty or no contest?
At this point, seven have reached plea deals with the prosecutors, and of the remaining eight, only three have reached the next level, which is the circuit court level, but so far no one has actually gone on trial.
And two of the more high-profile criminal cases are against former State Health Director Nick Lyon and former Chief Medical Executive Dr. Eden Wells. The most serious charges: involuntary manslaughter in connection with the Legionnaires outbreak that we all remember caused the death of at least 12 people. What is the status of their cases now?
Well, both of their cases have reached the circuit court level. And at this point, we're waiting to see if the judge who is presiding over this is going to move forward with Nick Lyons' prosecution. He's expected to make a decision on that beginning sometime next month. Nick Lyons' attorneys had asked the judge to challenge the lower court ruling. They had certain issues with the way the law was cited in that lower court ruling. So it's possible that the circuit court judge could send the case back down to district court for Nick Lyons.
And what about Dr. Wells?
Dr. Wells' case, along with all the other remaining cases, is in limbo at the moment. The new attorney general has put someone else in charge of the prosecutions. And at this point, pretty much all the prosecutions are now in limbo as the Solicitor General and her team begins to reassess how to move forward with these cases.
Do we know why the AG's office made that decision to reevaluate those cases?
Well, it's important to remember that the first of these indictments came down 3 years ago, and since then it has been a very plodding prosecutorial effort. And it, you know, at this point with a new team in place, they wanted to see what is the status of these investigations and, you know, what needs to be done and how to move this forward. And that's a process that's taken quite a while.
Do you have any reason to expect any trials to start soon or any more imminent plea deals or no contest pleas?
At this point, everything's in limbo, so it's kind of hard to tell. I would say that there is a possibility that we may have more plea deals before we actually see trials, though.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. As always, Steve, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Much more from Flint after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, as we've been discussing, 5 years ago this day, April 25th, 2014, Flint's drinking water source was switched, setting the stage for the city's water crisis. And the city has struggled since. But as Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports, Flint is showing signs of recovery.
It all began with an optimistic toast.
Here's to Flint.
Here's to Flint.
Here's.
With plastic glasses filled with tap water, Flint Mayor Dane Walling and other city and state officials toasted the switch of the city's drinking water source from Detroit's water system to the Flint River. The switch was intended to save money, but improperly treated river water damaged pipes, releasing lead into the city's drinking water. Outrage grew, and Flint residents took to the streets to voice their anger.
Flint lives matter!
After 18 months, government officials admitted the switch had been bungled. In October 2015, Flint was switched back to Detroit Water. But Flint was left with thousands of damaged pipes, families surviving on bottled water, and a battered self-image.
Alrighty, so we are going to do some highlights today. Freshen you up?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And then did you
Stylist Dan Busilli is talking with a client in his new hair salon in downtown Flint. Dan and his husband, David Custer, opened their business last month in a rehab print shop. Custer, who's also a local TV anchor, says Flint is better off now than it was before the water crisis.
I say, and we joke now, that we have some of the best water in the entire country now. We have brand new pipes throughout our entire city.
Later this year, the city hopes to inspect the last of nearly 30,000 pipes connecting homes to city water mains. Crews are replacing old lead and galvanized service lines with new copper pipes. It's still common to see claims on social media that Flint still doesn't have clean water. However, tests have shown Flint's tap water has improved greatly since the depths of the water crisis. Now it's well within federal and state standards for lead, even better than many other cities. Though residents are still advised to use filters on their taps as the pipe replacements continue. Federal and state funds are helping Flint fix its broken water system, and that in turn is attracting business investment. Lynette Phillips is the Deputy Director of Small Business and Workforce Development for the City of Flint. She says this year the city has about $200 million in new business investment coming in, from new auto parts manufacturing to a new culinary school.
Of course, no one would ever want to experience this travesty that the city of Flint experienced, but we have to be where we are and to move forward from that.
But while businesses are moving forward, many city residents are having trouble. Flint's unemployment rate remains high, and median income is less than half the state average, with more than a third of city residents living below the poverty line. And it's not surprising to see long lines still forming outside churches during weekly bottled water giveaways. Flint resident Melissa Mays has been one of the loudest voices during the water crisis. but even she can see some silver linings.
In some ways, we're better. In other ways, we're forever poisoned, damaged, traumatized. That's not going to ever be better.
Flint still faces a long road to recovery. For example, it will be several years before studies will be able to show if drinking Flint's lead-tainted tap water affected the cognitive and behavioral development of thousands of young children. It is the future of those children that will determine if Flint truly emerges stronger from its water crisis. I'm Steve Carmody.
And one of the most visible fighters for those children is here with us now, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. Her research into blood lead levels in the children of Flint forced state officials to accept that their cost-cutting decision had indeed poisoned the water and those who drank it. Dr. Mona, welcome back to Stateside.
Cynthia, it's always great to talk to you.
Take us back for a moment. What's your first memory of realizing something was wrong with the water in Flint? What images can you not get out of your mind?
Yeah, you know, it was the images of those moms holding brown water in jugs at, you know, town hall meetings and different community events and being repeatedly dismissed and denied. You know, that's when this crisis should have ended. Obviously, this crisis never should have started, but it should have ended within those first couple months after our water was switched, when people were in the amazing, heroic people of Flint realized something was wrong with the water. But unfortunately, they were really discredited throughout.
How have the last 5 years felt for you?
You know, my involvement really came late in the game. So if you think of like the uncovering of the water crisis as a series of dominoes, I was one of those last dominoes. It started with the people of Flint who knew something was wrong and they were loud and they were organized and they were trying to draw attention. Then we had amazing journalists who got involved, the EPA whistleblower, Miguel Del Toro, Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech. I mean, there was a series of folks who were raising red flags and alarm bells that something was wrong. My involvement didn't happen for maybe a year and a half after the water switch. In the summer of 2015, when I heard about the possibility of lead in the water, and that should have ended the crisis too. When you know lead in water, you know, you don't have to prove harm. My research never should have been necessary, especially when we know what lead does. So my involvement didn't really happen until a year and a half, and I regret every single day that I didn't get involved earlier.
And we should remind folks, it was September 2015 when you released your study proving kids in Flint did have elevated blood lead levels, despite the state's reassurances that everything's all right, nothing to see here. And they pushed back hard on you at first. Do you have any lingering feelings over that dispute?
No. My constituency is children. As a pediatrician, my work is to make sure that that the needs of kids are being heard and that we are doing whatever we need to do for kids. So I, you know, people can go after me as much as they want, but they can't go after my kids. So I have, and I, you know, I don't care about apologies or, retaliation, any of that. My interests are making sure that the children of Flint will not only recover, but thrive. And that's how I spend my day.
And where do you feel, here we are 5 years later, where do you feel Flint and its people, especially these children, are? What's better and what isn't?
Yeah, so we have really, you know, turned this crisis on its heels. And we have put into place really a model public health program to make sure that our kids have that brightest future possible. You know, yeah, the story of Flint is the story of a crime committed with absolute indifference to some of the most vulnerable people in our country. But it is also a story, and this is what we repeatedly want to share. It is a story of how everyday people, moms and activists and pastors and journalists and scientists and students and doctors came together to fight for children and to build something that will make the future of Flint kids brighter than really it ever was. So for Flint kids right now, you know, we have brand new childcare centers, expansion of home visiting programs, breastfeeding services, home visiting programs, school health services, a massive expansion of early literacy and Medicaid. The list kind of goes on and on of what we've been able to put in place to mitigate the impact of this crisis. We can't take this crisis away, but there is a lot that we have been doing to make sure that our Flint kids will thrive. And the neatest thing that's happened is that communities outside of Flint are paying attention, and there's these incredible ripple effects, not only in regards to safety of our drinking water, but really fundamentally how we care for children. And that has been totally awesome.
And certainly this has presented an opportunity, A, to help, continue helping people in Flint, B, to increase public health knowledge to be shared with everyone. So talk about the Pediatric Health Initiative. You're the director, and what are you monitoring, and how much have you learned?
Yeah, so our Pediatric Public Health Initiative was established shortly after the crisis to be that model public health program, you know, a center of excellence to do everything we can, working with hand-in-hand with community partners and children of Flint and parents to flip the story for Flint kids. So we are doing all kinds of different things, and I think the biggest project that we've undertaken is the Flint Registry. So this is funded by the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. It is a massive community-informed registry where we are identifying folks who are exposed to the crisis, seeing how they're doing, and most importantly, getting them connected to the services to promote their health and development. We've already had about 6,000 people start that enrollment process. About 400-ish have already completed enrollment into the Flint Registry. And most importantly, hundreds of folks have been referred to the services like childcare, like Medicaid, like neurodevelopmental assessment to make sure that they're okay and have what they need. So this registry is modeled after things like the World Trade Center Registry and other kind of big public health registries that have been put in place often after crises to make sure to see how the people are doing, but most importantly, to improve their health and development.
And we should note on this fifth anniversary, the Flint Registry is signing up people in five locations until 8 this evening. And all you have to do is call 833-GO-FLINT to get details. Dr. Mona, as you continue monitoring Flint's children, what still keeps you up at night?
Oh, there's so many things that keep me up at night. And I think the most pressing thing is the long-term recovery. All those awesome things I talked about that we're doing for Flint kids, from early literacy to Medicaid expansion to home visiting programs, those are all time-limited in funding, either from the state or the federal government or from philanthropy. And it's a lot of my work is continuing to ensure that we have the resources to do this work, because this is long-term work. So that's what keeps me up at night is, are we, you know, it's constantly writing more grants, continuing the advocacy to remind folks that our work is long-term work.
And your book, What the Eyes Don't See, certainly tells the story. It was chosen by the New York Times for its 100 Notable Books of 2018 and just selected as the Great Michigan Read for 2019. So you're going to reach more people to share your take on what happened. Let's say that you and I are talking on the 10th anniversary of the start of all of this. What do you hope to be able to tell us?
Well, I'm going to put it in my calendar because we are going to talk on that 10th anniversary. And I look forward to sharing with you in a very kind of academic, data-driven way what we've been able to do for Flint children, how this story wasn't a story of a crisis, but really a story of incredible recovery and hope. And that is kind of the data and the stories that I look forward to sharing with you.
One quick question. Do you drink the water from the tap in Flint today?
I do. I drink filtered water from the tap. My day is consumed with coffee, which is made of water in Flint, and it's all filtered water.
Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise.
Flipping that switch 5 years ago today caused one of the worst public health crises in American history. Contaminated, tainted water, corroded pipes, lead poisoning, deaths from Legionella. Harsh lessons about environmental racism, government negligence, arrogance, the consequences of cost-cutting and ignoring aging infrastructure. So let's talk about what the rest of the state can learn from what happened in Flint. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith is with us. Lindsay, is it fair to say all Michigan cities have been impacted by Flint, whether they know it or not?
Absolutely, yes. Of course they have. I mean, the biggest change is that the state adopted the toughest rules on lead in drinking water in the country because of Flint.
They did. So where are we at from where we'd been before?
So it was a pretty broad change. It's hard to kind of underestimate the changes that are coming, and they're phased in over the next few years. So it'll take some time. But we lowered the action level, what's considered safe for lead in drinking water. They closed loopholes in water sampling. So you're testing better, you're testing more frequently, and you're testing specifically at the right homes with lead service lines. It also requires all lead lines to be replaced, even if a city doesn't exceed the action level. So even if your water is considered safe, over the next 20 years, cities are going to be required to replace these lines, and they have to replace the entire line. They used to be able to just do a partial replacement, and the homeowner was responsible for the part of the line that went through their property. The state has gone away with that, and that is something that's being challenged in court, but As of right now, there is a ban on partial replacements, which is great. And then the last change, which is really important for the public, is there's so much more required transparency. Cities must tell the state where lead lines are by next year, and they have to inform people living there in those homes within 30 days of locating a line. So you have to get a public notice to your address.
So as I think about what kind of protection this gives us, I'm wondering, would all of these, with this tougher standard and all of these reforms, would that get officials to move more quickly than they did in 2014 when people in Flint were turning up to city meetings with those bottles and jugs of discolored water?
Well, I think there's two important things to say about that. I mean, one, the city and the state did not follow the existing lead and copper rules. So, I mean, it's hard, you know.
That was a mindset issue.
Not only that, but they literally, like, that they got in trouble for not following the existing mm-hmm. rules. The other thing that adds as part of this new law, the changes in the new law with this more transparency issue, is there are going to be requirements for setting up councils for bigger water systems so that if there are issues, there is a place, a platform for the public to deliver those kinds of complaints to a body that's sole purpose is to listening to those mm-hmm. complaints. So I think that'll be a big deal if problems ever arise in a given water system.
And certainly, you know, we know, as you indicate, very clear that Flint did not corner the market on lead pipes and service lines. So we've seen changes, we've seen reforms, but you mentioned there's some objections. We've got some governmental units objecting?
Yeah, there is a lawsuit that's been filed in the Court of Claims of the City of Detroit's Water and Sewer Department, the Great Lakes Water Authority, the City of Livonia, and the Oakland County Water Resources Commissioner. They are suing the state over the new regulations. The specific rift seems to be about money, of course, and who is responsible for replacing the full line, because there has been some previous decisions that make it so that municipalities aren't responsible for upkeep on private property. So if they are replacing the full line, including somebody else's, you know, property, that part of their lead service line or galvanized pipe, those cities argue that that's something that another court case has obligated them not to be able to spend public resources on private property.
What about our schools? Remind us what happened in Detroit last August.
Yeah, so last August, Detroit came up with some lead and water samples that were a little alarming, to say the least, and they shut off all of their drinking fountains and set up these water filtration systems. Schools are not required to test for lead and water, so there's no regulation that's pushing that. That was not something in the new law. But it is something I would certainly say in the state of Michigan, many schools have done without regulations. Some have paid up from it, you know, out of their own pocket. The state has made available some grants to do schools testing. Governor Whitmer would like to spend, I think it was $60 million, a budget line item in her proposed budget, that would provide these filtration systems to schools so that in a way, it's a cheaper solution, although a temporary solution, than if you have problems with PFAS or lead service lines. Just for kids especially, there's a sensitivity around their health.
I think anyone who's paid the slightest bit of attention to this whole Flint saga has to wonder, should I worry about what's in my tap water? So what are things we can do for ourselves? Let's start with, how do I know if I have a lead service line?
Well, that is the most important thing you can do. Go to your basement, if you have one. Figure out where your water comes into your home. NPR made an amazing app to try to help people figure out what is buried underneath your in your house, what's coming into your house. So there's an easy way to kind of look if you can access it. You can also contact your municipality. Some municipalities have those records. Some of them are really good about it. Others are not. And at the very least, you can start to be the squeaky wheel that gets them out to maybe figure it out. But besides that, I think anybody and everybody who has a lead service line or a galvanized line should get a filter. If you can afford it, get one. A faucet filter, certified, NSF certified. That's a great idea. If you can't afford it, the simplest thing you can do is flush your water after you've been gone or if you haven't run your water. So first thing in the morning, let your water run for 2 minutes. That just kind of flushes out a lot of that initial larger corroded lead that might come into your tap water from the lead service line overnight, or if you've been at work all day, or if you have a cottage up north, flush that water before you take that first drink out of the tap. That's the best thing you can do.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith, as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening to this special edition of Stateside on this, the fifth anniversary of the switch to the Flint River.